Welcome to Everything Life Coaching. I'm John Kim.
And I'm Noelle Cordeau. We are the founders of Lumia.
And we're super passionate about all things coaching, and we want to share what we've learned from over a decade of coaching and training thousands of life coaches.
Let's dive into the science and magic of coaching.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Everything Life Coaching. Noelle here, and with me today, I have one of my favorite people to talk to, Deanna Moffitt, an alum of our Lumia program, our Lumia instructor extraordinaire. Rave reviews come from powerful questioning that lives in your sandbox over on the Lumia side of the fence, and director of the Rewrite program, and author of a phenomenal book, The Rewrite. Deanna, thank you for joining me.
Noelle, you know I would never miss an opportunity to have a conversation with you. I love to be in a conversation with you.
Oh, same. And I read your book before we hopped on together. So I just want to shout out, it's awesome. And I'm in it. So it was really weird to read
I bet it was.
section about me. And I loved it. I got so much out of it. And, you know, truly looking at all of the different facets of storytelling and how people have changed their lives, picked up their pieces, moved on, built the pieces back into a different fashion. It lit a fire under me. So thank you for creating this work. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so much for actually being a part of it. It was a joy to interview you and to have your story in the book. And, you know, as I wrote the book, I have to tell you, there were some of my own stories that I had to confront and do some rewriting of, for sure.
Well, beyond what I've shared with folks, orient our listeners. A lot of people listen to our podcast as a companion to their coaching journeys. Who are you? What do our listeners need to know about you in the world?
Who am I? Well, you know what? I feel like I am a ball of light and energy. So that would be the core spirit part of me. And I embrace it fully. And I feel like a large part, I'm a joy generator, and I also embrace that fully. So that's the kind of core spiritual part of me, of who I am. But outside of that, I'm a coach and an author and a speaker. One of my great joys is actually teaching for Lumia, and I teach several courses. I started with The Art of Questioning, and, you know, I had to tell you, and I always tell the story, and John's like, oh, it didn't happen that way. But when I graduated from the iteration of Lumia, this was several iterations before you joined as CEO. So, I remember talking to John after my graduation, and I said, John, I still don't know how to be a coach. Like, this would, you know, it was a lot of theoretical talk about the coaching school, but I didn't know how to have a coaching conversation. I could stand in front of 1,000 people and give a talk, but how to sit down across one person. I said, John, I think you need to have a class on questioning. He goes, oh yeah. Well, would you do that? And I'm like, that's how John is, right? Just bringing people in. And I was like, John, I literally have never actually had a coaching conversation in my life. He goes, yeah, you'll figure it out. Yeah. And I'm so glad that he trusted me and that I said yes to it. And it was because of that I really learned to understand and love questions. Understanding that the question is actually way more important than the answer. And so really embracing the power of our questions, not only for our clients, but for ourselves and our own life, and how those questions can be a lens with how we experience things.
Absolutely. A concept that I've been rolling with a lot recently is how little in our adult lives we actually take the space for reflection and to ask ourselves what we want. And I've been polling people, you know, when do you do this? When do you actually stop and ask yourself what you want? The dominant answer is food.
That's a really good.
I will ask myself what I want for dinner.
But that's hilarious. That's the extent of it. And even then, there's the whole line of answer it, they'll be like, oh, I don't know. I don't care. Like, we can't even get to what we want for food. Yeah. That's so great. And isn't it funny? Don't you think people know what they don't want? They can tell you what they don't want.
Yes.
When you ask someone, hey, what do you really want? And they're like, oh, well, I know I don't want this, this, and this. Like, okay, that's great.
Yep.
And what do you want? And there's just that long pause of like, I have no idea.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And, you know, I think this is a moment that'll kind of lead us into the topic of storytelling, which is the topic of your book and a huge pillar of your life's work right now. So much of the way that we construct our worlds is around the stories that we tell ourselves, not necessarily the questions that we ask of ourselves. And so for you, taking this deep dive, really, you know, the interplay between questioning and storytelling, what do you see as the impact on humans?
Well, you know, our creation of our stories often happen, especially our core wound stories often happen before 6 or 7 years old, right? Before our brains are really in a beta state or beta wavelength. So we're creating stories through the lens of a brain that isn't quite formed fully to be analytical. So we take it in and we really think that all the things that happen to us are because of us. We can't contemplate that the adult situations around us. And what that means is that when we create these stories of I'm not worthy or I'm not lovable or I'm not enough, which I think a vast majority of us, especially in the Western world, seem to be living by because of the experiences that we had with caregivers, with churches, with schools, with these out external experiences, it really means that we are living our lives based on past experiences that may have happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. And we are living a past life as opposed to thinking about, wait a minute, is this story even true? And I can tell you what, it's not. And is there a better story I could be telling myself? And what would be happening if I did?
Absolutely. And I think that's directly linked to what do I want for dinner, right?
Yes.
Yes. We live in the land of I get to choose for myself and at every moment design the most delicious moments for myself day in and day out. We would joyfully approach the question of what do I want for dinner?
Yeah, right. And part of that is, you know, I think I lived a story for a long time that I'm a burden. And I think that that story came to me in utero, to be honest with me. I feel that story came from a birth mother who had to go through her own experiences of being a boyfriend leaving her, her having to leave Colorado, go to a women's center to give birth in California, leaving her family, the fears and everything about that. And I can only imagine that exchange, that energy exchange happening in utero, and then being left in a care center for several weeks and not being actually cared for in that care center. And I only take that away just knowing how my adoptive parents came to me and that my tear ducts were clogged. You know, I didn't have tears and all this stuff. Anyway, but I think I took on this story of I'm a burden or I have to show up perfectly in order to be loved because otherwise it's going to go away. And imagine anyone who's listening to this, if that's your story, how you're going to show up in the world.
Yes. Yes. Right. So what do we do about this?
Well, I think part of it, you know, I do think the first part of it is just an awareness. And the awareness can really come in the results that we're getting in our life. Mm-hmm. Are we in relationships we don't want to be in? Do we find that ourselves pleasing other people to a great degree? Are we bending over backwards to other people? Are we staying stuck in careers or jobs that we don't really want to be in? The results are the outcome of the story that we're telling ourselves. So oftentimes we can't really dig into the find the story first, so we can really look at what are we getting in our life? What are the results? And then we can kind of backtrack to, okay, what's the story I'm telling myself that keeps getting me this result?
Yeah. And I think implicit in what you're saying is awareness. Awareness. Yes. Of the story, awareness of the script, awareness of the somatic feeling mm-hmm. that the story brings up. I know, thinking of my own childhood, I always had an uneasy feeling in church. Like mm-hmm. I would go to church on Sundays and I would have a really uneasy feeling. And it wasn't until adulthood that I was even able to identify, oh my gosh, I was having a somatic response. I didn't yeah. like my environment. I was reacting to something within that environment, whether it was judgment or whether it was the temperature of the people around me. But I accepted it as a signal that something was versus information that I was having an experience.
I love that you shared that. I think as I went through the process of writing that book, what I understood more and more is that it's really difficult to just mentally change the story because the story is in our bodies. It's living here as well. And so how do we move that energy? How do we change that story in our bodies as well? Because our bodies are the first bookcase of these stories.
They are. The body always goes first. And yeah. Humans have become so disconnected from mm-hmm. that aspect of knowing. When I talk about this, I often invite folks to think about the way they experience a wincing, whether it's their throat, their mm-hmm. chest, their stomach, is it the back of your neck? How does your body tell you that your thought is traveling through a neural mass that houses memory that's upsetting, right?
yes, that's such a great way to put it. And it really is, we try and disregard the signals from the body, right? Mm-hmm. And we think we put heavy weight on the thoughts, which are trying to just keep us safe and maybe push away the reality of what's happening. But what you're saying right there is so critical, that the what's happening here in our bodies first will always be an indicator.
Yes, it is. It is an indicator. And then the way that our brains work and what they hang on to, I think, is equally important for awareness. So our brain takes in hundreds of billions of bits of information every second, but we can only bring 44 pieces yeah. into our consciousness. And the reason that we do that is to make sense of the world around us. So our brain literally picks and chooses what to bring into our consciousness to create a story.
Yeah. And that data, that 44 pieces, is often being passed through to confirm the story we're already telling ourselves, right? So if I'm unlovable and someone doesn't answer my text right away, well, there we go. That confirms the story.
Data. Yeah. And it's that aspect of the way our brains function is a form of bias. It's called the availability heuristic. And the way it works is, you know, taking us all the way back to evolutionary times, if we had a memory of something, a berry, a plant, a river, either it worked for us the first time and it didn't kill us the first time. And so therefore, we're going to continue to carry that data point with us because it gives us information about what didn't kill us. Now, fast forward to 2024, then the text message that you receive that gives you information about whether or not you're lovable, this evolutionary trait doesn't work for us anymore.
No.
And our brains have to work almost 3 times harder to scan our reality for new pieces of information that will actually help us construct a different story.
Yeah. And you brought up a really good point of that. You know, we are living that story and where we're at is all in our subconscious. Remember, you talked about the awareness, right? That awareness piece. And that is the work of bringing this story up into our consciousness. But the research behind how much we are having the same kind of thoughts on a daily basis. We had these thoughts yesterday. We're having the same thoughts today. That we're only living at our conscious level about 5% of the time, right? 95% of the time, we're in subconscious land. And we're just doing patterned behavior, patterned thoughts, the same thing over and over again. So what you said earlier is so critical. Can we bring awareness to the conscious level about what's happening below the surface?
So as you were writing your book and you were interviewing, you know, so many people to collect their stories and then the journey that they went on, I imagine there was a point of harnessing awareness that took place for almost every single subject. What did you notice? How did this show up for your subjects?
You know what I noticed truly is that almost every single person had someone beside them. It's really hard to become aware of what's below our surface without someone who can witness us. And Thomas, I remember being in a workshop with her saying that we create our stories in relationship with other people, right? A baby doesn't come into the world thinking I'm unlovable. It's because of what they experience with the people around them that they then create that story. All of our stories are created in relationship with other people, which really means that if we're going to create a new story, we need to be witnessed by and affirmed by people. And so every single person had someone, a coach, a trusted friend, a mentor, someone in their life that was able to help them point to different data that could confirm a new story, and then witness them and see them and help them see the different data that's available to them.
Yes. As I was listening to you, I was like, well, this is why coaching works. You know?
Exactly.
Fundamentally, philosophically, tactically, like this is the why, you know, behind coaching. And what came up for me too is the power of socialization. Mm. And there's a part of the brain that's called the orbit frontal cortex.
And it gets your book is coming. Just tell me your book is coming.
You keep telling me about this. No, I'm going to hide in the bushes. The orbitofrontal cortex gets activated when people experience pleasure and experience greatness. So what you're describing as that validation, that witnessing, that moving forward, it can only come from an experience of social pleasing, as it were. And there's an experience that sits in opposition, which is wrongness. And that's when our pain centers get lit up. And that also comes from social construction of culture that signals to our brain basically death. It's the death feeling. And so we have this juxtaposition of, you know, the rules of culture dictate for us what's okay, how it's okay to behave, what we can do, what we can be, what we can say, how we understand ourselves. And on one hand, people telling us we're cool gives us pleasure. And if people telling us we're wrong gives us death feelings. it's quite a juxtaposition.
Yeah. And then as you say that, thinking how we can go off path through our inauthentic self when we're trying to continually please other people and their story for us, right? And
I
see that all the time. I want you to be this, this, and this, which takes us off our rail of our authentic selves, what we really want. And we go off and to get that pleasure center, as you're saying, we start pleasing other people and their desires and wants for us.
I've often wondered how much of our world was constructed by people trying to avoid the death feeling, because it's an awful feeling, you know, that physical wincing of I've done something wrong, I'm being judged, being punished, I'm going to be isolated is one of the world's worst feelings. And I've been wondering, is it a matter of getting used to that feeling in order to push past through and actually ask yourself what you want for dinner? Or is it a matter of looking out more towards the positive reinforcement?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting. I can see that avoidance of that death feeling. And what I would want to bring into this conversation is the idea that everything is temporary.
Yes.
That even if for a moment or for a while you experience that feeling of wincing, of painful, of extra ostracism, that you don't belong, that in itself is temporary. And I think what we need to hold for ourselves is our gentleness, our soul, right? That part of us to know that we are never alone. We are always with ourselves. And this feeling of separateness too is just temporary. That if we hold to the truth of who we really are, that in itself is an attractor. We will find the people. And the people will find us.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to switch it up, right? Thinking about every single innovation that has ever come to pass has required risk, criticism, rejection, and ultimately doing something differently.
Yeah.
As you were taking this deep dive with folks in the book, what was the most surprising thing for you as folks began to change the story? What were the characteristics of that moment?
Yeah. Most everyone found it was kind of the dark night of the soul moment. It was, I don't want this anymore. I may not even know what I want yet, but I know I don't want this. Mm-hmm. Rand Ewing, who is also a student at Lumia, and he was very vulnerable and shared about an experience that he went through that landed him in the prison system. And the strange thing was, he shared with me, is the moment he was handcuffed, he actually felt a sense of great freedom because he knew this moment was going to change him forever. And he didn't want what he had created and experienced for himself. And that all of a sudden it was like, I can, as strange as it sounds, I can exhale because I know my life is going to change here.
Yeah.
He didn't know how, but he knew it was going to be for the better in some way, even at that state. And I think for many of us, we reach a point where we are done. We are done living a script that someone else gave to us, a belief system that's no longer serving us, a people-pleasing that is no longer bringing back the energy that we so desire from other people. And we reach a point where I don't want to do this anymore. And so how do I want to approach my life? What does that really look like? And it is the dinner question. It now becomes, what do I want?
What do I want? And then, I think too, we live in a society where there's such on-demand everything. And one of the concerns that a lot of people have for society vis-a-vis tech adoption is that attention spans are shortening and that the call of consumer-based immediacy is creating almost a societal dip into entitlement of comfort, of speed, of now. And the work of change, once you decide what you want for dinner, is actually quite long, hard, arduous. Thinking about the people that you interviewed, how long did you witness the true change process taking?
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that in, because I do think it's an evolution. Listen, I'm 57 and I'm still evolving. I think I shared with you, as writing the book, I had to confront several of my own stories. And I think there's this desire that we can be like helicopters and we just lift off the helipad and we've changed. right? But in reality, we are fully loaded, full passengers, full-bellied 787 Dreamliners who need, you know, a three-mile runway to even get off the ground. And part of it is that acceptance of the process and the journey of evolution, of human evolution, of our own personal evolution. And dare I say, even looking for the joy in the failure, the fall, the step back, the two or three step back. So, that, oh, here I am again. But noticing that in that two or three steps back, you're still ahead of where you were a month ago, a year ago, in evolving your story or recognizing your ability to choose something that if you, and I'll say this, I think people think that we really learn from experience. Mm. And I don't believe that's true.
Tell me more.
I think we really learn by reflecting. Because we all know the person who's, you know, been dating the same kind of person over and over again. You're like, you are not learning, my friend. You know, here they are again. You know, we're not learning from our experiences, but it's only when we can take a moment and reflect on our experience and really look at it and say, okay, well, what was I doing to bring that in? How did I allow my boundaries to let go? What wasn't I choosing? What was I choosing to hang on to when I could have let it go? Right. And so it's in the reflection that we actually learn. But boy, to the point of what you're talking about, that entitlement and wanting everything immediately, rarely are we stepping back and allowing ourselves to just reflect in that experience.
Yeah. I mean, what's coming up for me is that that's another really great aspect of why coaching is a functional and important discipline, is implicit in the framework. Is the space.
Absolutely.
You know, and adults don't create space for themselves to reflect and to strategize, which is why the container of coaching almost gives permission for that lost art to come to the fore, you know, for humans.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and I want to just make a distinction around here that it's not a reflection on just looking at the pain and what got us there. But it's also a reflection again about the dinner question. Okay, well, this happened. Now, if I don't want this to happen again, or I don't want this experience, what do I want to do instead? What do I actually want to claim for myself that I want to move toward? You know, so it's not just circling around the drain around our problems. I don't know that that actually serves us greatly, but it really is a reflection on, oh, this was my experience. What do I want? And what do I want to do differently to get to a different outcome?
Yeah. One of the intake questions that I have in my own coaching contract is, what do you want more of in your life? And what do you want less of in your life? Yeah. And to really kind of just lay out the distinction between the two. And what's interesting to me is I've been doing this for 16 years, and I so rarely take the time for myself to ask those questions.
Yeah.
Because it takes space.
Yeah.
And bravery.
Yeah. Bravery, honestly, is a good term. Yeah. You know, again, it's the power of the question. And that's really, you know, in the book, I had three different sections. One is looking at the stories of our past, the kind of the core wounded stories that we carry in our backpack with us for, you know, that's the I'm a burden story for me, or I'm alone. And, you know, those stories really dictate our behaviors, whether we know it or not. And then there's the stories of the present day moment, the stories that get us hooked and while we're in traffic, or someone cuts us off, or a relative says something that really pisses us off, right? And we get hooked into that emotional state. One of the most important stories is the story of our future. Mm. What is it that we want to create? And putting our energy and our focus there, you know, it's the new story. It's the story of, who am I really? What do I really want to create? What are the relationships I want to have? What is the career I want to have? What is the energy I want to have? Because that pulls us into a future that can feel open and expansive.
And to your point about almost everyone in your book having a trusted person, you know, a trusted mirror, in looking at society right now, these times in our life for questioning, reflection, rebuilding, charting the future used to, in most Indigenous societies, have space. There was ceremony, there was ritual, there was a medicine person where when you were at a crossroads in your life, you would set the intention of, you know, what can I learn? What can I bring back? Who will I be next? What can I contribute to my community? And all of this has gone away in so many ways. And I'm starting to think about coaching and coaches and programs and the way that the wellness space has bubbled up as social first responders, you know, in this way, and that folks are utilizing coaches, community prompts, programs in order to kind of go on these heroes' journeys. I know you have a program called The Rewrite. What is it? I'm sensing that this is the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for mentioning it. You know, I started the program 2 years ago, and the book was, you know, kind of born out of that. And the 2 years I've done it, they've been completely different programs. And I am going to do a third iteration this year. And again, this is my creative, you know, not satisfied with the status quo, wanting to create something else. But it really comes from my current understanding of not necessarily focusing on our core wounds and changing that and, you know, making sure, you know, reliving whatever trauma that created that. I think there can be something really helpful in that. But it's really, as you said, focusing on what is the intention that I want to create. That was such a great word. And I think there's so much power in creating an intention of what it is I want to create. And, you know, I've now spent a year, which isn't a lifetime, but a year focusing on my work in the energetic field of Qigong, which is energy work, and understanding and the breath work, and really understanding that when we set a clear intention and we are aligned with it, with our body, our mind, our emotional being, that there is a co-creative force that really helps us live into that intention. And that's, you know, I said earlier, oh, I know deeply I'm never alone, because I know deeply that we are immersed in a sea of energy around us that we cannot even know about. I mean, we can't experience with our senses.
The right? Quantum level.
The quantum, it is out here. I believe it deeply. And choosing to, you know, create an intention, and then my secondary choice is, how do we elevate our energy so that that intention can be created easily, right? Mm. And so the choice of being in a positive state of joy and love and gratitude, which is where it becomes our little antennae attractor to that. You know, I've gone so far now with even all of my business emails, I'm signing them off with much love, you know, to corporations. Like, this is who I want to be. I don't care who it is. I just want to put love out there. And if it shifts something, or if it makes someone feel like that doesn't feel appropriate, why not? Why doesn't it feel appropriate that we can send love to each other?
Yeah, you know that I love love. Love is like, is one of my favorites from a neurobiological perspective. It's an agreed upon micro moment of mutual care.
Yes.
There's eye contact. It is one of the most phenomenal phenomenons that we can experience, you know, as humans. And to your point about the energetic field, another fun fact of mine that I love is that our atoms are constantly bouncing in and out of reality.
Yeah.
Where do they go? Where do we go as we bounce in and out of reality?
Yes, exactly. I get so excited about this. You know, this level of understanding that I have, knowing that my level of understanding is in the basement, right? There's so much more for us to discover and know about, but there just seems to be a truth in it for me. And I get curious around, you know, the hurt and the pain that this world is in right now, I really feel is because we have lost or we have disconnected from our own energy. And we are disconnected from the understanding that we are all energetically connected. And truly what I do to you, I'm ending up doing to myself. So as we're in this world of judgment and, you know, hate and separateness, that we are actually causing ourselves pain. And that's part of why this world is suffering. And so I'm a voice out here saying, what if we walked around in an energy of love, of gratitude, of joy? How would this world shift?
Yeah. I mean, I live in Philadelphia. I'm going to try it and see what happens, you know, like, thankfully the football season that didn't go too well is over now. So
your Eagles are going to come back. They're going to come back.
We'll see. But no, I mean, no, I'm truly on board with you. And, you know, to your point of what we can create when we shift our lens, when we shift our energy, when we shift towards love, towards compassion, towards making someone's day brighter, being a fountain instead of a drain. I love life design theory, which is out of there. It was originally used to train sculptors and for tech adaption. And something that I use often is the idea that at any given time, there are 5 to 7 paths and they're all good. All of them are good.
Tell me more about that. Tell me, can you expand on that?
Yeah. So, you know, in our hyper goal focused achievement centered economy, society, and so on, traditional goal setting theory has been set up to ascribe to a belief that you set a goal, you suffer through the hero's journey, you employ grit and you do the hard work, and in the end, you will hit the goal. Well, that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to build your way forward based on what is, which requires asking yourself questions like, what do you want for dinner? Because you take a step and you have to pause and evaluate, how did it go? Did I like the step? Do I want to take the next step in this direction? Are there any other pieces of information that have come into my periphery that are new now that I have taken this step? Is there anything else that I'd like to build on? So if I don't want to go to the left anymore, if I'm like, oh, well, going to the right actually looks much better right now, do it. Take that next step in another direction, because it's kind of like the zigzag of a choose your own adventure story, where the outcome is actually based on what is than that which we wish to bend into reality. Dancing with reality versus trying to mold it.
I love that. Yeah. You know, that first way that you talked about of like grit and resilience, you know, I do a lot of work in the corporate space, and every time someone wants a workshop around that, I'm like, okay. And I wonder what would happen if we asked ourselves a question, what if it didn't have to be so hard? What if we could create with joy? What if we could actually bring in, again, this co-creative energetic force that we could work with that allows us to be in a flow of things as opposed to, you know, muscling our way through anything? You know, you certainly can create from that space, but as I think about that, I think that's what leads to a lot of burnout and lack of desire, lack of wanting to do it again, because that was just too hard. And, you know, of course, and I actually feel like I have a high level of resilience and a high level of stick-to-itiveness, but I also think that there's a way that I can create, and I invite that for anyone who's listening to think about around, how can I create from a place of joy? Or a place of, you, like you said, questioning and say, hey, is this the next step I want to take? And if the answer is, I'm not sure, is that I'm not sure coming from a place of, no, it's not right for me, or from fear? And I question the fear.
Yeah. Or do I need more information?
Yeah. Do I need more information?
I need more information. You know, Lumia has been a grand experiment. And yes. You've been with us from the early, way back days. Yeah. And that premise of, can we have fun? Can mm-hmm. we build an organization on love? Can we build an organization based on joy is really the basis of that experiment. Sometimes we get it right. Sometimes we get it wrong. But
you always get information.
Always get information. It's antithetical to the way that we're taught success happens to work in this way. But I mm-hmm. think that the more we all have these experiences of working in this way, and we all gain exposure to navigating the world based in joy, based in love, based in openness, as our atoms bounce in and out of reality, mm-hmm. The more, I don't know, opportunity we have yes. as a global society to start change.
Yeah. And I think, I want to believe, and I know there can be a sense of naivete around this, but I just really want to believe that the world will reach a point of, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. No, I don't want this. This doesn't feel good in my system. I don't like the way I feel right now. And what is it that we really do want? But it's got to start. Like, I know change only happens through the stories we tell ourselves. Even cultural or social change happens because of the stories we start hearing. And if we can really be the storytellers of hope and possibility, and working with clients to give them the understanding that there is possibility, change can happen. Creating attention can be really powerful. Asking what you want for dinner and beyond is the thing that we really need to be doing for ourselves. Not asking what we don't want, but what do we want for dinner and what we want for our life. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's been such a pleasure hanging with you today.
Well, listen, we could do this for hours, I know.
For hours and hours. where can folks find you? How do you want folks to communicate with you?
Yeah, come to my you can come to my website at deannamoffitt.com. I do offer a 30-minute session, and it's a coaching session. I don't do discovery calls because I feel like people will get a better sense of what it feels like to go through coaching if they haven't to actually be coached. But you can also go to Amazon.com and find my book at The Rewrite, Deanna Moffitt, yes. And or you can reach out via email at deanna@deannamoffitt.com. So lots of double letters and all that. If you don't get them all right, you're going to reach some woman in Ohio. So.
Amazing. I hope he has a good sense of humor.
Me too. Well, I just got to leave you with this, my friend. I love you. I love what you're doing. And I just have always loved your brain and what it is noodling on and playing with and creating on a regular basis.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I'm just delighted and grateful that you've been such a huge part of Lumia, building the program, the Lumia family, and just bringing your light and energy to everything that you do. So.
It's been one of my greatest joys, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, folks, it's been fun. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Everything Life Coaching. If you're feeling the draw to become a coach, head to lumiacoaching.com/everything. Explore a new career that brings fulfillment, gives you a true sense of purpose, and a bold community to do it with.
Lumia is ready to equip you with the tools, training, and community you will need to reach your goals. If you're ready to build a unique coaching business on your own terms while making an impact on the world at large, Lumia is the next bold step in your coaching journey. That's lumiacoaching.com/everything.
And hey, if you're waiting for a sign, this is it.